Welcome to JW Podcast, the Watchtower Jenga of podcasts that takes down the organization one brick at a time.
Hello, welcome to another JW Podcast, the Australia series, as I'm beginning to call it. I've got my comrade with me, Lara. Hi, Lara.
Hi, Louise.
How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very impressed that you're up again early today because we spoke to each other yesterday, 6 a.m. your time. So I'm really impressed that you're up already today.
I'm only able to do it, Lara, because I've got half term off school next week. So otherwise I would have complained bitterly at having to get up at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay, well, I've gotten you up because I've got a really special guest today, and I know you're going to introduce...
Yes, we've got an exciting guest with us, another one of your lot from your end. You probably live really close by, don't you, because we all know that Australia is really small. And we've got someone called Daniel with us. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Louise. Hi, Lara.
Hi.
Lara, I'd better let you introduce Daniel.
I will. So Daniel is my cousin, and I was thinking today, because knowing we were going to have a chat, of my childhood memories of Dan, and I was thinking about how our families used to spend a lot of time together, and I've got a photo in my photo album of Dan and I in a little shell-shaped bath, like a little pool in the backyard or the front yard of his house. So that's one of my enduring memories of our childhood. And another memory of our childhood was our JW lives. And I remember being very zealous, I guess is the word. And I remember like playing trains with Dan, you know, on a weekend night when our parents, I'm sure, would be arguing the finer points of doctrines. So that's some of my enduring memories. And, of course, today we're adults. So I don't know what Dan's going to tell us today, but I'm very keen to hear because I left 25 years ago and Dan left about 7 years ago.
I'm interested from you. I probably left officially around about 5 years ago, five or 6 years ago. But essentially I sort of drifted away over the last 10 years. So it took me quite a while to make the final break. Because obviously, if you don't know anything else and all you know are witnesses and all your friends and relatives that you hang out with are witnesses, you have to build an entirely new life from scratch. And also, there's a lot of other issues that you've got to deal with, as probably most people know who have left. You've got to build a new framework in your mind of how life actually works and how the world works and what it all means. So all of that took a period of time.
So Daniel, can we wind back a bit? Can you tell us the journey from the moment that you were in the shell bath with Lara to how you ended up in Bethel, please?
I don't know if I can. I can't remember that. Sorry, Lara. My family were very close-knit. They were the model witness family. So my father is still, I think he's still an elder, I'm not sure, but he had, you know, quite a lot of responsibility. Everyone knew us, so we had a really high profile, in the organization, and everyone knew me. So I was like the golden boy, in my congregation and had a lot of responsibility or a lot of expectation placed on me as to what I would do. So I would have to say that for most of my life, I believed, I went along with everything, I believed it. I obviously had doubts. I think all witnesses, if they're honest with themselves, do have doubts, but you always try and push it out of your mind and go, well, you know. And the other thing is I'm the firstborn in my family. So with the firstborn, there's a lot of pressure to meet your expectations of the parents. So I didn't realize this at the time, how much I'd been, you know, pressured that way. But now when I look back, I can see it clearly that a lot of the time I was doing things because it was what was expected of me. So
I just want to let Louise know, because she doesn't know this and other people listening. So about 6 or 7 years ago, I guess it was, Dan reached out to me, and as I had been out so long, I had already created a new life. And so Dan reaching out to me, and it was really how it felt, but Dan reaching out to me felt like I was being pulled back to something I didn't want to be pulled back to. And that involved talking about things. I just didn't want to hear those words anymore. I didn't want to hear witnesses. I didn't want to hear indoctrination. I didn't want to hear apostate. I just didn't want to hear all that language and have those feelings. And so, therefore, I was not very receptive. And today, I feel really regretful, and I did not understand how much that help is required. And I also did not understand that even people who are not asking for help need help. So I am sorry for that, and I would like to go on record to say that that shouldn't have happened, and I apologize for that, and I wish I'd been of more help, and I hope that other people will listen to this and consider it in their own way.
Apology accepted, Lara.
Thanks, man.
We're all on a journey.
Yeah.
So what part of my life did you particularly want to touch on? Did you want to touch on...
Well, how did you end up in Bethel?
Okay. So... as I said before, I had a lot of expectation placed on me with my family having a fairly high profile. I just grew up knowing that one day I would become full-time work, volunteer work for the witnesses. I just didn't even think twice. That was what my mum and dad had brought me up to believe. That was what I was going to do. And of course, during school, I did have some opportunities to go down other tracks. So I was also like a top student at my school, and I had some opportunities, but Mum pretty quickly jumped on that and extinguished any of those ideas in my mind. And like, when you're brought up to believe that, you know, becoming a full-time servant and going to Bethel and doing all of those things are going to make you happy, and everybody around you tells you that's what's going to make you happy, you think to yourself, well, you know, they must be right. What reason would I have to doubt it? So when I left school and pretty much immediately started full-time volunteer work as a pioneer. I got part-time work, but I was living in a country town where it was hard to get good work, and I found it frustrating, the kind of work that I was doing, which was working in an apple orchard. And anyway, it was during a recession here in Australia. And one day at the meeting, they announced that they were looking for young guys to come to Bethel and learn a trade. And I thought, well, that way I can kill two birds with one stone. I can learn a trade and I can do what everyone, you know, what I'm supposed to do. So I went to Bethel, and it was a construction project. So I wasn't officially part of the Bethel family, but I was there in Sydney branch for 3 years, which is longer than a lot of Bethelites stay. So during that time, I did learn a trade. So there were some good things about it. To be honest, I had a fantastic time. There were a lot of things that I enjoyed. I made a lot of friends. And being a young guy, that's really what I needed. And that's why I find it hard to have regrets about things, because at that time I was very happy. And anyway, so then after 3 years, I got invited to go to Japan branch. And so, I mean, why wouldn't you want to get out of Australia and experience new cultures? So I jumped at that chance. And to be honest, travel is the best thing that any witness person can do. Travel. And I don't mean going and staying in a hotel. I mean real travel, like just getting out of your little bubble that you've grown up in and going and seeing the world. So this gave me a chance to leave the bubble and to go and Well, I was in another bubble. It was just that it was a Japanese bubble, but at least it was in another culture. And so I got to see things from another point of view to realize that the way that I've been brought up is not how everybody gets brought up, and that there's billions of people out there that are different, think differently, and you cannot put the humans all into the same box. So that was an important lesson that I learned, and I really, really enjoyed that time in Japan Branch and learned a lot about myself. And then after that, I spent the next probably 10 years going to different branches around the world. So all over Asia and the Pacific. So I got sent to Samoa, I got sent to Thailand, Sri Lanka. Also, I went to Malaysia to help out there. Oh, there's probably a couple of other places. Oh, Papua New Guinea as well.
What were you doing? Was it a particular job, or was it just, I mean, that sounds like an amazing opportunity just to travel around different places.
Yeah. So I was based in Melbourne, and I would work in Melbourne, like doing pioneering in Melbourne. I had my business. So I started a business doing painting because that was my trade. I had a successful business, so it allowed me to save up money. And then they would say to me, you know, do you want to go to this country? And I'd say, sure. So I had a dream job and dream life as far as any witness was concerned. Like, people used to just say, oh, you're so lucky. And I was very fortunate, you know, like, to see the world. But the great thing about doing that is that it opened my eyes, because I started to think to myself, I've been brought up in this religion in a little town in Australia to think that I've got the right religion. But yet when I go to these countries, I'm meeting people that have never even heard about Jesus or Jehovah or Bible. They got no idea, and many of them never will. And it started to play with my conscience, because I thought, what right do I have to come here and tell them that, you know, I've got the true religion? So,
and that they're going to be destroyed if they don't get my religion. I mean, I used to think that, and I hadn't even travelled, and I used to think it seems really weird that, you know, what are the odds that I would have got the right one first time? It's like, wow, I'm so lucky. But it seemed really it seemed really hard on all the other people who had accidentally been born into not the right one and were going to have their eyes pecked out, and I'd have to dig the sad, rotting bodies under after Armageddon. I just felt a bit mean, yeah.
And you realise that a lot of people from other religions are absolutely lovely. I met some Muslim people who were very peaceful and loving and, very nice people. And that was the same in every country that I went to. You start to realize that the world is not just one big evil place. I also came to the realization that what I had been told about the whole world having a witness was actually false. There were billions of people that had never heard of witnesses, and even if they had no idea why we were there or what we were doing. So this idea that everybody was getting a big witness was just a lot of rubbish, really. And I sort of got frustrated, because I knew that that was what I was supposed to do, and I'd come home, come back to Australia, go to my local congregation, and sing songs with everybody else, and all the local witnesses had no idea of what I'd just seen, and they thought that they were superior to other people because they'd go and spend a couple of hours every week door knocking and going to meetings, not knowing that there were billions and billions of people out there that had no idea what they, you know, who the witnesses were even. And so couldn't reconcile it in my mind.
My dad travelled to South America, and he, it was a similar kind of thought process to yours, but he was meeting people from other religions who were going through the same existential crisis about, you know, clearly I've been born into the right religion, and what if I leave? What will God do to me? And I think he met somebody from a different religion who was saying all the things that my dad was saying, and my dad was like, "Hey, I'm the right religion, and God's going to destroy me when I leave." And you think you're the right one, and God's going to destroy you if you leave. And he just realised that there were loads of people from other religions going through that same terrifying process of what if it's the right one. They were a bit further down the line of leaving and thinking, you know, I've kind of faded away and now God's going to destroy me. And it just made him realise it was a nonsense. It was an arrogance to think that yours was the right one and you'd be destroyed.
Absolutely.
There were other people going through the same thing. So travel, I totally agree, is a massive mind expansion.
And can I ask a question just a bit more about Bethel? So you mentioned that you did a trade. What was the trade that they put you through? I didn't know they did that.
Painting and decorating?
Yes, because you said to me some time ago that you were mentoring other children or teenagers in, I think, Southeast Asia. And so I think you were helping them do some construction work, as you mentioned before. So can you tell us just a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so because I was good at my trade, and painting wasn't the only thing I did. I did a number of different trades. So I got fairly multi-skilled. And then I would go to these countries. And the reason why I was sent over there was to train up local people to be able to build kingdom halls and Bethels. And that was when I'd go to these countries, I'd be put in charge of groups of local people and teach them my trade and teach them skills. And I think, you know, I think that's one thing that I really enjoyed, and I think it is good that witnesses did stuff like that. However, it was really just the tip of the iceberg of what really needs to be done, obviously, to help people in developing countries. I became very close, made very close friends, a lot of close friends with people in these developing countries. Yeah, like, it was fantastic opportunity. But I always left the country thinking to myself, I cannot believe that all these millions of people here are all evil and they're all going to die, you know, the ones that aren't witnesses. It just didn't make sense to me. But I just kept pushing those doubts out of my mind. Eventually I got asked to go. I had a breakup with a girlfriend, and dating, by the way, was really, really hard because I would find witness girls quite boring because they hadn't actually been anywhere. It's not their fault. It's just that's the, you know, they hadn't had an opportunity to see the things that I had. So it was hard to date. And I found, I started dating a girl overseas. That all blew up. And then I had a lot of guilt. And then after that, I just put in my application for everything that the witnesses asked young men to do. And I got accepted to what was called the Ministerial Training School. So that's like, they used to call it Gilead for single guys. I don't know if it's, I'm not sure whether it still exists in the form that it was, but anyway, so then I went to Bethel for another 2 months in Sydney, and we spent 2 months solid. I think it was at least 2 months, could have been three, I can't remember exactly now, but it was at least 2 months solid, every single day, studying. And we were expected that when we came out of there, we were going to take on a lot of responsibility. And we got sent all over the place. Some guys got sent to New Guinea. Others got sent to outback areas in Australia. Anyway, that period of time was really interesting because I basically spent time in the Bethel Library. We were encouraged to go to the Bethel Library and study. And so that gave me access to a lot of stuff that most witnesses would never ever see. And all of those books and magazines that the Watchtower and Awake magazines and the Watchtower refer to, a lot of those books were there, the actual source material, and I got to access it. So, you know, I'd read something in the Watchtower and go, well, I want to see the original source where this is taken from. So I'd find the book in the library and I'd stay up to like 1 o'clock in the morning reading the actual book where the quotes were taken from. And I discovered that a lot of the stuff was actually being taken out of context. Because I had the book there in front of me in the Bethel Library, and then I could see that it had been taken out of context, and things were being, you know, they were picking and choosing what they wanted to present. And I didn't say anything during the school because I couldn't. Like, everybody was watching us. Like, we were, every single thing we did was monitored, and I mean everything. So we couldn't. You know, we definitely were not allowed to go and think for ourselves. We were told to, but the reality was we couldn't.
Oh dear, it sounds like you'd started thinking already. That's a very dangerous thing to do. They've let a dangerous man in to the inner sanctum of the library, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. So I've actually heard several other graduates from that school. Actually, they had the same experience as I did, but we never would dare say that to each other at the time. But after we graduated, I think there's quite a high percentage of people that actually ended up leaving because they had a chance to dissect, witness beliefs. You know, they had the time to dissect it, to analyze it, to use critical thinking. Unfortunately, most witnesses never ever get that chance. So you can't blame them for not being able to use analytical thinking. And I was once again very fortunate that I had that opportunity. So I would say at that point, I was really starting to think to myself, is this really true? Like, can I really follow this my whole life? Do I want to invest my whole life into this? And I would say that that really actually shook my faith.
Yes.
How old were you?
I think I was around about 30, 31.
Can so. I just interrupt there, Daniel, just to say another thing about family, and that is that look at the difference between my family and your family. Like, we've got the same grandparents, our mothers are sisters, and they would have been raised pretty much the same way. But, you know, my father was a scientist, and I became a scientist, just coincidentally, not because he was, but coincidentally. And therefore, I got to learn that critical thinking when I went to university. And so, therefore, I had a real fast track into critical thinking. And the second thing was, my mother was disfellowshipped. And you've said it to me before, if my mother had never been disfellowshipped, would I have left? You know, I might not have been catapulted into the world so quickly. And so therefore, you know, and also I'm a middle child. Middle childs are always the troublemakers. So firstborn and you having parents that were still in and you following that path that they set out for you, what different lives we've had. Funnily enough, we've had some similarities, you know, with our travel. We both love travel. We both love being in the outdoors. But, wow, our lives have been really different for 25 years.
Absolutely. And it's been great to reconnect with you, Lara. So at the time when I did reach out to you, I guess maybe you weren't ready to really help me, but even the little bit of help that you did give me just helped me to see that there was, you know, that I could do it, so that I could break free. So, yeah, every little bit did help. But anyway, after I graduated from the MTS, I got assigned to a congregation, and quite soon, within a couple of years, I was made an elder, and I was given even more responsibility, and I would give talks at the conventions and the assemblies, and I was the guy that got interviewed as an example of, you know, the model JW elder / whatever. So I got to the top I got to the top of the organization, everything that my mum and dad had brought me up to do, I did. Everything that I was expected to do by the organization, I had done. I'd done it all. And I wasn't happy. I was not happy. And I thought to myself, why aren't I happy? I've been told this is supposed to make me really happy, and I'm not. I had no lasting relationships with, I really wanted to have a girlfriend, but I couldn't find anyone in the organization that I really connected with. I felt like everything I did was being watched, which was true because I was supposed to be an example to everyone. So I couldn't even date anyone without everybody talking about it. Like, everyone would just talk about it, and you know what it's like. You just get so much pressure. And I just thought, this is ridiculous. I can't do anything without people, you know, sticking their nose into my life. So I kept all of this inside me. Of course, I didn't want to let anyone know because I was supposed to be like the example. I was supposed to be the one that everyone else came to. I got asked to support the hospital liaison committee, and I got assigned to the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, which is like our main emergency hospital. It's probably one of the biggest hospitals in Australia. It's the main emergency hospital for the whole of Australia. Like, it's the one that we have all the critical cases, and people get helicoptered in from all over the place to, you know, whenever there's an emergency. So I was in a really high pressure situation where I would have to go and sit with people while they were dying, or when, I'm sorry, just when I think about it, I would sit there and I'd hold people's hands while they would die, and I'd have to counsel or help the families. The family would come in and they would come to me, and then I would have to help, you know, help them deal with different things. And I would wake up, I would get phone calls at 1 o'clock in the morning to go in and be with someone who was having I was with someone who had a heart transplant, of all things. I think she was the first witness in Australia to have a heart transplant without blood. And I'd go there like 2 o'clock in the morning and pray with her husband. And this was the kind of thing that I was doing. And of course, I had to deal with all the doctors, nurses. It was really high pressure. And of course, I couldn't talk to anyone about it because I was supposed to be, you know, just relying on Jehovah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, sorry. Daniel, can I just interrupt for a second just to say, yeah. I, funnily enough, also was working in hospitals probably at that time. And in fact, I worked at the Alfred Hospital as well. Who knows if you were in one corridor and I was in another, but prior to my work at the Alfred Hospital, I used to work at Cabrini Hospital in Melbourne. And that's where I started my work in hospitals. And I remember reading a patient chart, and on the patient chart was who had been my mother's best friend. Her name was Poppy. And she was my mother's best friend when my mother had been a witness. And I saw her name on the chart. And even though I hadn't been a witness for about a decade, I was compelled to go and visit her. I didn't think about any of that. I just wanted to see her, hold her hand, ask her how she was. She was in ICU, and I went straight into the intensive care unit to see her. And, you know, I just wanted to hug her and tell her how much I loved her and missed her. And she was on erythropoietin, which was helping to boost the oxygen in her blood. And at that time, I didn't realize how sick she was. And so I was just thinking about my own happiness to see her, not thinking about her life ending. And she was dying. And at the end of less than half an hour of me spending time with her, she said to me, "Thank you, Lara, for coming to see me. It's been wonderful to see you. Please don't come and visit me again." And I knew why. I wasn't coming to visit her again because I was an apostate in her eyes. And so I guess to live in the next life, she needed to be free of complications like me. And I respect did her wishes. And I don't know if she lasted maybe that month. And she was just such a beautiful person. So I know in some ways how you feel, but I did not have that immediate patient kind of transaction that you did on a daily basis. Mm. However, there were hospital liaison committees that I didn't even know existed at that time. So not to take anything away from your story, I'd love to hear more about that, but it's funny how you can be having an experience that's totally unrelated at the same time in a similar place.
Yeah. And the scary part is that the men that are doing these visits and that are, like, I had access to the ICU. I was actually classed as a staff member of the hospital and I had my own little office. And the scary part is that I hadn't even completed high school. You know, like, that is just crazy when you think about it, really, is that I had some training, but what kind of training, really? Only the training that I'd received through the organization, which they say is supposed to make you capable of handling all of these things. But the reality is I was dealing with people who had mental illness and I had no training in mental illness. In diagnosing it or, knowing how to handle people. So I love helping people and I would bend over backwards to help people to the point where it actually impacted on my private life, my personal life. I had no time to do a lot of things that I wanted to do. And, I think that also, I eventually got a book on mental illness, like an actual medical book, and I started reading it so that I would actually be able to understand different types of mental illness. And I realized that there were a lot of people in my congregation, people that I was dealing with, who actually had undiagnosed mental illness. The symptoms were all there. These people were not getting any treatment because they were told, oh, just come to the meeting, you'll be fine, you know, trust in God, pray more, all of those things, go and talk to the elders. Whereas these people, what they actually needed was medical attention. They actually needed to go and talk and have an appointment with a psychiatrist or a psychologist and get treated for their mental illness. So that's another thing that really bothered me. And
was that in your as an HL member, Dan? Was that related to the hospital work or unrelated?
Yeah. So like some of the patients that I'd have to go and see were in the, there's actually a ward, the psych ward at the Alfred Hospital. So I'd have to go in there as well. And being an elder in the congregation, there were people that in the congregation that had mental illness and they needed medical treatment, but instead they just got offered a Bible study and told us, and I'd have to study with them because no one else would do it. You know, no one else was going to put up with their problems. So I gave a lot, got no idea. 14 years of my life in full-time volunteer work for the Watchtower. So I know what I'm talking about. Like, you know, I can talk to any elder, anyone in Bethel. Yeah. I stayed at Brooklyn Bethel. I had friends at Brooklyn Bethel. So I saw it all. I've had conversations with governing body members, all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, then I just realized that there were so many holes in what we were doing. The final straw came when I was an elder in a congregation and I had to go and counsel a woman who had left her husband because she told me that, well, she told us, bunch of men, two men came into her house and we were supposed to help her. And she said to us, my husband makes me watch porn and I can't handle it anymore. He doesn't love me anymore. So I don't want to deal with that anymore, so I've left him. And I was supposed to go in there and tell her to get back together with him. And I was thinking to myself, this is crazy. I can't say that to her. Like, if she doesn't want to be with this jerk, what right do I have? I don't even have a girlfriend. It's just crazy. That was like I came home that night and I was like, that's it. I don't want to do this anymore. I have got no right to go and tell other people how to live their life when I don't even have my own life together, you know, like I'm happy. And about a month after that, I got invited to go to Papua New Guinea. And I was like, okay, great. I've got to get out of Melbourne. I've got to get away from everything. I've just got to think. And I paid for my air ticket to Papua New Guinea, but I also just got a round the world ticket. And I spent so I went to Papua New Guinea, did my thing there. I was there for 3 months, I think. Yeah, okay, it was interesting, did my work. And then after that, I just left and flew out of Papua New Guinea and went to Hawaii. And I went to Hawaii and I backpacked around the world for about 5 months.
Did you just go off grid? Were you still going to meetings or did you just flew off grid and nobody knew where Daniel was anymore?
Well, everybody thought that I was going to all the meetings and, you know, that I was still doing my thing. And I did go to some meetings and I even went and I was cheeky enough to even go and stay in Bethel in Santiago in Chile. And because I hadn't made an actual decision at that point, I just knew that there was something wrong. I didn't know what it was. I just knew that I had to think. I had to work it out. I had to make a decision. So 4 or 5 months of backpacking around the world, and I went everywhere from Hawaii to the bottom of South America. I backpacked all through the US, Ecuador, Chile, Iceland, then through Europe. I ended up in Hong Kong and Bali. By the time I got to Bali, I was like, you know, I really realized I didn't believe it anymore, but I didn't know what to do. I was trapped because I knew that when I came back to Australia, everyone would just expect me to go back to what I was doing before, and I knew that I couldn't. So I did come back to Australia. I told everyone I'm not going to be an elder anymore. I went back to my home congregation with my mum and dad, and I just kept a really, really low profile. So I said, I don't want to be an elder. I can't. I didn't tell them the real reason why, but I just had to, I started blaming myself, to be honest, because everyone says there must be something wrong with you. You've got to pray more. You've got to go to the meetings more. You've got to, you know, you've lost your relationship with Jehovah. So I did all of the stuff that they tell you to do when your faith is being shaken. I did it. And it didn't work. Right? So I did all that stuff and it still didn't make any difference because I knew that it just wasn't true. And so then I ended up moving up to Byron Bay. Byron Bay is a hippie town in Australia. It's, a lot of people say it's paradise. If you ever come to Australia and you ever come to Byron Bay, you'll see what I mean. It literally is paradise as far as, you know, what most people would consider paradise. Amazing beaches, awesome surf, everybody's walking around in bikinis and board shorts. And I went and lived in a rainforest in a shack. And I just started thinking. And I started reading a lot of books. I read Richard Dawkins. I read books about, I think, how you explain it. Byron Bay is a very alternative lifestyle kind of town. So I started looking into other types of spirituality to see if there was anything there that I was missing out on. I read the Bhagavad Gita, which is like the holy book for Hindus. I read the Quran. I read, a lot of stuff. and just really wanted to find out, what do I believe? If I'm not going to believe what I've been taught to believe for most of my life, I've got to replace it with something, because you can't just have a vacuum.
Okay, I found that interesting, you see, because I think that argument of that the witnesses use of, well, you know, where would you go, where would we go, Lord? I think that's a bit of a trap, because I think you can just believe nothing until you know. Personally, for me, but I think maybe in your situation, I'm amazed you haven't burned out. In fact, I'm amazed you haven't had a major health breakdown from what you described to me. I think most people in your situation, doing what you were doing with nobody to talk to, nobody to go home to and bounce ideas off, would have probably had a big health breakdown. So the fact that you still managed to work through that, yeah, I can see that you would maybe look for something else.
The more that Dan talks, actually, it sounds like my father's journey when he was young. My father never met his father, and he was searching for something. And he read all of the books as well, and he was reading psychology books and books like, I know Dan's reading at the moment, 1984, and all sorts of philosophy. And it was because he hadn't, possibly because he hadn't had his own father, so he didn't have direction. And I think what Dan's trying to explain was he was so directed that he needed to find a new direction. And I'm the same as you, Louise. I didn't need a new direction. I just wanted to escape and be free. But not everyone feels that way. So, Dan, did you feel that way then and you don't feel that way now? Or how do you feel now, and did you break down?
No. I'm a pretty strong person, and so, no, I didn't break down. In fact, my mum and dad started telling other people that I was having a nervous breakdown, and I'd say to them, no, I'm not. I'm perfectly fine. In fact, I'm actually feeling better than I have for a long time. You know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just thinking. And, you know, that's something that I feel really resentful about, is that people got told that I was having a breakdown, and I wasn't. I was actually thinking clearly for a change. So, I think it is important to have some kind of structure of what you believe. You can't just go from believing in God and believing that you've got the right religion to just saying, well, I don't know anything. I think long term you have to come to some kind of decision about how life got here. Like, either you believe in God or you don't. You either believe in evolution or you don't. Because those decisions make a big difference to the way you live your life. If you understand that evolution happened, that it's real, that we are a product of nature, and it helps you to understand yourself and other people. If you don't accept that, if you still believe in God, well, then you might end up falling for another religion. So you've got to make a decision. What am I going to believe? Have a look at different religions if you need to. I did that. I made a decision. I didn't believe any of them. And I settled on, I had always thought, even when I was at school, evolution made sense to me. I was the top biology student at school. The biology teacher wanted me to go to uni, and I got offered a scholarship. Mum and Dad said no. So they would say to me, evolution doesn't make sense. But I actually did understand it. Even at the age of 16, it actually made sense to me. But I just thought, okay, maybe I'm crazy, you know. But then when I looked at it again, I'm like, everything I've seen in the world points to the fact that evolution's happened. When I traveled through South America, I saw plants that only exist at the bottom of South America and in Tasmania. Now, why? Why are they only in those two places in the world? Obviously, there must be a connection there. So things like that all started adding up in my head, and I just decided, yeah, I've got to believe in evolution. And it actually made more sense to me and made me happier to have resolved that in my mind. Yeah, then I started looking to make friends that weren't witnesses, and that took a few years as well. So it took about 3 or 4 years to try and make friends, because it's really hard to make friends with people that aren't witnesses if you've never done it before.
It's really hard.
It's the hardest thing.
Yeah, because you've spent your whole life knowing that they're all going to die. And you've held back emotional connections. So even when you've mixed in school with people that you like, you've held back inside because they're going to die. So what's the point? And I find it's really easy to cut people off, I find, because, you know, you were able to do it as a witness. So it took me a bit longer, actually, to make friends than you. Yeah. I think you did really well.
Dan, can I ask a question about a little bit more about Bethel and the documents that you found in the library? Because you just mentioned about how you saw a similar plant in Tasmania and down in southern South America. And I've been to 30 trees and I've seen that type of thing, and I find it so exciting because even though I'm a chemist, biology is actually my favourite subject. I wish I'd been a biologist. And what was fascinating for me is the Wallace line, and I know that you've been there, both been to the same place. There's a Wallace line that exists between the islands of Bali and Lombok. And the Wallace line is essentially a deep trench of water. And on one side, you get the large mammals like tigers. And on the other side, unfortunately on our side, we don't have any of those really exciting carnivores. But on our side, we have...
I'm quite happy about that, Lara. I'd rather have kangaroos than tigers myself.
Yeah. And it makes Louise jealous. But we also have things like, you know, parrots that you don't get on the other... cockatoos you don't get elsewhere. But in terms of that similarity that we've seen, you can only see that when you've been to a place and you've seen it with your own eyes. So earlier on, you talked about the documents you found in the library.
Yeah.
Up in Bethel. And so I'm interested, and I'm putting you on the spot here, but is there anyone in particular that comes to mind?
Okay, so if you read the actual original watchtowers from the 1800s and, you know, right through to the 1920s, there's all kinds of crazy, nutty ideas that they believed back then. Now, it all gets swept under the carpet now, but, you know, I've read those articles. I actually took photocopies of them, and I've still got them here in my, you know, like of stuff that Rutherford and Russell believed. They had all kinds of crazy theories about the pyramids of Egypt and all kinds of stuff like that. And I've got the proof, you know, like you can't dispute it. You see that and you go, well, how on earth did they believe that? It's so blatantly wrong. So, you know, but also the Watchtower quotes a lot from some commentaries, say, on the Book of Revelation. And they'll choose excerpts from these commentaries to support their particular doctrine on the interpretation of the Book of Revelation. I found the original books that they were quoting from, and I read them. And the explanations given in those books actually made more sense than what I was being taught. You know, like, for example, if you understand the fact that the Book of Revelation was written at the time when the Roman Empire, there were things happening with the Emperor of Rome, and that all the references to Babylon the Great are actually talking about Rome and, you know, the seven mountains and all of that. Rome's built on seven hills. Everybody knew that. So all of those things that are referenced in the Book of Revelation are not talking about events in the 20th century. They're talking about things that were happening back then, almost 2,000 years ago. The people that read the Book of Revelation back when it was written, they would have known exactly what the guy was talking about, if it was John, I'm not sure, but whoever wrote it, the readers understood that he was talking about the Roman Empire, who were attacking Christians at that time. Now, that is supported by history. It makes a lot more sense than trying to force the Book of Revelation to fit the events of the 20th century. And the more you think about it, you go, why would the Book of Revelation, why would there be like this massive gap between 100 AD when the fulfillments were supposed to happen, which was 1914 onwards? Like, do those 1900 years of history or 1800 years of history, what do they all mean? That they, God just forgot about them? So, you know, so I read this book that was an explanation of the Book of Revelation as the Book of Revelation was intended, and I thought to myself, this guy's right. He's actually nailed it. Like, this is what the Book of Revelation is really all about. It's not about a prophecy of something that's going to happen in 1800 years' time. It was about events that was happening right then. Once you understand that the Bible...
Are you telling me that the scorpions with the yellow jerseys don't mean the tracts that the Watchtower Bible Tract Society put out? Serious?
Yeah. Sorry to break it to you. But, yeah. I actually don't know what they mean. I can't remember. But,
And leaflets written by Rutherford and Russell.
Yeah.
I mean, that book that we used to study, it was really reaching, wasn't it? It was just extending your credulity as far as it could go. But most witnesses were just so stunned and tired and overwhelmed with life that they'd sit through the Tuesday book study, which doesn't exist anymore, reading that claptrap, and it just skidding over the top of their heads, because what they were probably thinking was, what am I making for tomorrow's tea? When can I get Sandra to bed? What do we need for school tomorrow? Have I got enough for packed lunches? Or will I get out on field service on time? You know, just like, most witnesses don't even think about that. You, I think, are a particularly unique person who wanted to actually know and study and read things. And that's hard for a witness. If you're a reader or a studier, your life is 10 times harder than the average witness, I would say.
And I had the chance, the time to do it, you know. So not many people get that opportunity. A lot of the other guys that were in my class, it was their first time to Bethel. So they were overwhelmed with all of the special treatment that they got. And for them, it was like the best thing that had ever happened in their life. You know, so they came out of that school on fire. You know, they went back to their congregations and, I don't know, they just thought it was the bee's knees. I had already spent a lot of time in Bethel, so to me, I was like, yeah, I'm used to all of this stuff. Like, I'm just here to study. And all the fancy stuff that goes along with it, the way they make you, build you up to make you feel like you're someone special, that didn't wash with me anymore. It didn't impact on me. I was like, yeah, I've heard all that before. So I was thinking a lot clearer than a lot of the other guys there. So I had that opportunity.
Yeah, so Daniel, those that you've got in your cabinet, I know that Avoid JW would love to see those documents. If they don't have them already, I think that's the place to archive them.
Well, I haven't seen anything in... there's nothing that I've got that hasn't already been made available or hasn't been documented or that someone hasn't written a blog on or there's a website going into detail. The website JW Facts, which was created by Paul Grundy. Now, Paul Grundy was actually at Bethel at the same time as me.
No, shut the front door.
I know him quite well. So... he used to be the waiter. Anyway, so I came across, when I started doing research to alternative explanations of JW's, I came across his website. And I'm like, this stuff actually makes a lot of sense. I still think to this day that his website is the best one out there. So I thought, who's this guy who wrote all this stuff? And when I looked at it, I'm going, that's Paul. I know Paul. He's the waiter from Bethel.
He's my waiter. How dare he?
I couldn't believe it. And yet at the same time, that actually made a lot of sense to me because I'm like, yeah, he saw all the same things I did. And we were, like, I think he's maybe a year or two older than me. So we were, you know, very similar age. And I was like, I can't believe that here's another guy who's come to exactly the same conclusions as me, and yet we've never spoken about it, you know?
Yes.
So that was like, when I read that stuff, I'm like, yes, he's right, he's right. How could I have been so stupid? Like, and a lot of the things that he's got on there, the thing I like about that website is that he doesn't blame people. He's not emotional about it. You cannot be emotional. As soon as you put emotion into things, then you become just like the witnesses themselves. It's spelled out very clearly and using logic, pure logic. And to me, that made a big difference. So, you know, hats off to him. I think that he's really done a great job there. I've never published anything. In fact, this is the first time I've gone public with any of this stuff. So.
Yes. And it's very brave, Daniel. Thank you.
Yeah, hugely grateful. So can I make a suggestion for those amazing photocopies that you've got? Could you photocopy them and make them into Christmas cards? Because I love a Christmas card with a nonsense Watchtower belief on it.
I've got a postcard of Bethel that I collected. I've still got in my photo album, and I'll send a photo of it to you at Christmas time. How about that?
Yeah, that would make me supremely happy. Thank you.
Daniel, I've got another question, and that is, what did you do when you had this realization? So you slowly, slowly, bit by bit, worked yourself up to the top, and then when you got there, it wasn't everything that you thought it was, and you had your thinking year.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah, that's when I went and started living in Byron Bay. So I just left everything. Everyone in Melbourne knew me. I had a very high profile. So I just left everything and went and lived in Byron Bay in a shack in a rainforest. And I was in a place where no one knew who I was. I still went to the meetings, but I told everyone that I was just, you know, I just needed some peace. And the congregation did kind of respect that. They didn't push me to do anything. They probably got told a whole heap of garbage by my parents and the people in Melbourne. But I really didn't care anymore what people thought. I was really over it. So after about a couple of years, I eventually just one day I thought, okay, I'm now prepared to come clean and tell people what I really think. So I didn't want to go out with a bang. It would have been, sometimes I think it would have been nice to, like, I really, really, really could have done a lot of damage on my way out. And sometimes I think to myself, like, you know, if you're going to go out, maybe take as many people as you can. But I'd seen what happened to other people who did that, and the witnesses just close ranks and they just say, oh yeah, that guy was crazy anyway, right? I didn't want people to think I was crazy. I wanted people to know that what I was doing was a very well thought out, logical conclusion that I'd come to, and I wasn't doing it because I just got sick of being a witness. I was doing it because I just, like, researched everything and decided that it wasn't true. It was not the truth. I wanted people to know that. So I just met with the local elders and I just said to them, look, I just want to be left alone. I don't want to cause you any problems. I didn't want to be disfellowshipped and I haven't been disfellowshipped. I just wanted to be left alone. And I said, look, I'm not going to cause you any problems. I'm just letting you know I won't be coming to any more meetings. And then one elder met up with me for coffee and he said to me, tell me why. And I said, well, these are all the reasons. And I spelled them out. I actually had them written. They had 10 reasons why I was leaving. And I kept it next to my bed in the bedside cabinet. I just had the 10 reasons written down so that any time I had doubts about leaving, I'd just look at them and go, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And it'd give me the strength. So I told him the 10 reasons and I said, if you can answer those 10 reasons or those 10 things, I'll come back. But I dare you, you can't. They are irrefutable. And I said, if you think you know more about the organization or the Bible than me, you're dead wrong because I'll beat you every time. I've read the Bible more than every single elder in this entire King Hall. I've studied it. I've been to Bethel. I've done it. You hate it. I've done it. And I'm making this decision. So if you want to argue, bring it on because I'll blow you away. And anyway, he didn't know what to say. And I just said, yeah, if people want to know why I'm leaving, let's go for it. I'm happy to argue, but I'm not going to go and out there and try and convert people. This is the decision I've made. And if people want to know, they can ask me. Anyway, I thought that in my ignorance, I thought that that was a really nice thing to do. And I told my family, so my mum and dad came up and I took my mum and dad, sat them down and just said, look, this is what I think. This is the decision I'm making. And I was amazed by how few people actually wanted to know. They didn't want to know why someone who'd given their entire life to the organization, who'd spent 14 years giving everything he's got, giving up his career, giving up his education, everything, relationships, giving up to the organization, why would he just turn his back on it? They didn't even ask. I could not believe it. And to this day, most of them still don't know because they've never asked.
No one ever asked me, I don't think.
Yeah, they just assume that you're a wicked person or, you know, you want to smoke or fornicate or something. That's what they put it down to. So they don't imagine that maybe you've got logical reasons.
When you land in a support group, it's one of the first things that you want to talk about. You want to talk about why you left, and people want to ask you why you left. So it's really funny that those people you've known for longer and you would have thought more intimately don't ask.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that you didn't get disfellowshipped, actually, given that you had outlined. Because as soon as you said an elder came and spoke to me, I thought, here comes the trap where they ask nicely, you know, what is this all about? And then whatever you say, that's used as the basis of a judicial committee. I think that's a testament to how much people respected you, actually, that they knew that you were solid about your stuff, and they probably respected the amount of time and effort that you'd put in and just thought, we'll just give this guy a wide berth, maybe.
Yeah, well, it would have been nice to have just been left alone, and, you know, like, I had no intention of causing problems for them or for all my friends and family who were still in. I was hoping, I was a bit naive. I thought that I could just keep my relationships and believe what I wanted to believe. But they didn't take that, you know, like I wasn't going to go and spread my ideas or whatever. I was just going to keep things to myself. And yet they actually hunted me down. So my parents actually got elders to hunt me down, find out where I was living, because I ended up moving, and, yeah, basically try and get me to say something to kick me out. And to this day, they really have nothing, right? I've never had a judicial committee, nothing. But, and I said to them, look, I'm not writing you a letter or anything like that. So, you know, I'm not going to play your game because that's what they want you to do. They want you to keep following the rules. And I just said, I'm not following the rules. Why should I write a letter? I don't care. Who are you? You know, I know more about the Bible than you do. So why do I need to write you a letter?
Because fundamentally, it's a man-made religion. It's not, well, it's a man-made cult in my mind, but fundamentally, it's not what God's asking you to do. It's what men are asking you to do. And if you don't want to play by their rules, you don't need to. You don't need to be in that club. And so, Daniel, you mentioned to me, and I guess the topic of this was not so much the specific Bethel, you know, history, although that's been really interesting, and it wasn't so much that you'd been an HLC member, and it wasn't any of that particular thing, really, but what I wanted to, I guess, for you to showcase for us, the topic is manipulation. And if we pull out a couple of examples, which we've already done, that's really what you wanted to highlight. Is you said to me in the past, you can join any club and there's going to be good people and there's going to be people. And most clubs that you join have both of those. But the issue you wanted to highlight today was of manipulation.
Yeah, exactly. So I am still not angry despite all the things that my parents have done to try and, you know, and all the things that people have said about me. I'm still not angry at them because, and I very rarely say things about the against the witnesses. Individually, I don't attack them. I think they are all of them are victims. The only people that maybe aren't, maybe sometimes I think to myself, maybe the guys at the top, the very, very top, maybe surely they must realize that they're not talking from God. Do they admit? But I don't know. I don't know for sure. But so I don't really feel any aggression or anything towards them. But what was the question, Kamara? Oh, manipulation. Yeah, so one thing I do feel, I feel that a lot of witnesses obviously don't realize that they have been manipulated because they haven't had the chance that I did to actually investigate everything. They've accepted things that, you know, hearsay, they've been accepted things that they've been told. They haven't had the opportunities that I did. They haven't had a chance to travel the world. They haven't had a chance to go and spend time in Bethel. They haven't had a chance to actually meet the governing body. They haven't had a chance to actually study the Bible and the Quran and the Bhagavad Gita and to compare them all. They haven't had a chance to go back to the source material where the watchtowers were taken from. I had that opportunity, and I'm saying that you've been, if you believe the stuff, you've been manipulated, because I've seen it with my own eyes. And I guess that's the point of all of this, is that I saw it all, and it is manipulation.
Daniel, that is a fantastic story. I can't thank you enough for coming on and going public for the first time with a really interesting narrative of how you studied your way out of the witnesses. Laura, do you have a closing song?
It's like songs like the meeting. can you introduce the closing song for us, please, sister?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's hilarious. Yes, I have thought of a song that will suit today. So because Daniel did live in Byron Bay for a while, there is a really special artist who is well known in Australia. Her name is Missy Higgins. She's awesome. I thought you'd like her, Daniel. So I selected
saw her live in Byron Bay at the Blues Fest.
You see? There you go. So next time that we're in Australia, I'm going to take her up there and we'll get on our bikinis. Hey, Louise.
Oh, man, I've got one of those burka things, head to toe.
Bikini, your chef came and wore one of those at one of our famous beaches. Did you know that? That British chef, Nigella Lawson?
Oh, did she?
She came and wore it. I'll send you the photo.
Oh, yeah, do. Okay.
It's a Missy Higgins song, and I've stolen it from a movie called Don't Help, but it's in honour of Dan's bravery today. He's just told us about the manipulation we've experienced. And so I just wanted to play this song and say thank you to him for being so gutsy.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Louise. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening to another JW podcast. Goodbye. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Bob.
It's all ready for you.
Thank you.
Torchlight on the shadows, daylight to the black. I've been holding on to something, but I'm giving it back. If I could reach out to you, dear, reach back over time. If I could hold you, I'd tell you that one day we'll be alright. But sometimes people let you down, and sometimes evil is a quiet town where nobody wants to hear your truth, and nobody wants to believe you, but I do. Someone out there will torchlight in a locked room, unwind and untangle this mess. If I could go back, I'd hide you somewhere they would never guess. 'Cause you're a blank page right now, but they'll cover you in ink and black your heart out. Sometimes people let you down. Sometimes the kings are crowned. 'Cause nobody wants to see the light. Nobody wants to believe you're right. But I do. Someone out there will too. Torchlight. Gonna drag the dark into the torch.